Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books in Critical Theory. On this episode, I'm going to be talking to Dr. Victoria Cam, who is a lecturer in humanities at the University of East Anglia in the UK. And we're going to be talking about her new book, Girls Like This, Boys Like That, Understanding the Reproduction of Gender in Contemporary Youth Taste Cultures. So welcome to the podcast.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Oh, no, my pleasure. I mean, this is a fascinating book, and it's both, you know, kind of really important, I think, theoretically, but also in our kind of current context where we're constantly being told things about young people in the media, this really, you know, provides a lot of rich empirical data on what's actually going on with young people. So it's almost kind of perfectly timed.
That's nice to hear. I'll let my university research impact people know.
And it's funny in a way, because obviously the timing of academic books is always a bit random. And I kind of get the sense that this one has been really kind of like long in the gestation. And that's probably where we could start with the book, actually, is the kind of sense of where it came from and how it's sort of part of your broader academic career.
Sure, yeah. Well, the book itself came out of my doctoral research, which started a really long time ago now, I think. 2010 is when I started my PhD, and my aim was, as I think a lot of early career researchers, to get as many articles and publications out of my PhD as possible. But then, like a lot of early career researchers as well, the contracts that I were on really meant that I didn't have the time to kind of be producing that sort of thing, you know, going from teaching post to teaching post. And so it got to the point where it was taking longer and longer. And that was actually a really useful, I think, period of time for me, because it stopped being like, how quickly can I get this out? But actually, how can I write the book that I want to write? And so what I did was spend quite a lot of time, you know, thinking about what do I want this book to say? How much of my personality do I want to get into it? You know, and where do I want it to go? So the book itself is actually a much bigger departure from my PhD research than I'd intended it to be, but I think it's a much better book for it. So, swings and roundabouts being an early career researcher, I think.
I was really struck by this initial phrase. I think it was something like the regulatory role of taste that almost kind of summed up the book, actually.
Yeah.
And it'd be good to sort of unpack that, and I guess unpack it in the context of exactly what you've just said, because you've, you know, sort of gestured towards your working circumstances regulating, you know, kind of your ability to produce them. And then this idea of taste being a kind of key regulatory thing for young people's experiences.
Yeah, well, I think as an interdisciplinary scholar, I've always kind of straddled the cultural studies, sociology, media studies part of academia. And even when I was an undergraduate, I wasn't really sure where I fit. And I remember reading Bourdieu when I was in my first year. And I just remember just being really struck by how that spoke to my own experiences as a working class scholar, you know, working class student in quite a middle class setting. And so there's something about Bourdieu that I just really, really liked. And I was really interested in this idea of how taste cultures, they regulate and they classify. But I, you know, I kind of didn't want to write about class per se. And I was more interested as a feminist scholar, and I got, you know, really got my teeth into feminist theory, how it was that these ideas of taste as regulatory actually perform a really important role and a central role in how gender is reproduced. Because one of the things that I've been thinking about, you know, throughout my life is, you know, how is it that femininity and masculinity persist despite, you know, increasing public and academic understandings of academia and of patriarchy? And I thought maybe there was actually something that Bourdieu could tell us about that. And that's kind of where I got my teeth stuck into the taste thing.
I mean, it's particularly interesting because Bourdieu has a kind of a mixed reception and reputation with regard to gender. You know, some of his writings are what the kids call kind of highly problematic in this regard. And so it was really interesting to see Bourdieu deployed in this way. And I guess in a way kind of, and, you know, correct me if I'm wrong here, it struck me that you'd used Bourdieu as a way of kind of saying that the regulatory role of taste produces problems for young people. And specifically it kind of, you know, in regulating also kind of closes down possibilities of you know, who young people might become and, you know, what their lives might be like.
Yeah, I think that's definitely right. I think taste and I think regulation, you know, provides problems for people across their life stages and across their identities. And I think it's certainly a way of othering people, you know, and putting people into particular boxes. And that was definitely one of the things that I wanted to get to grips with. And also, I mean, I spent a long it's funny because actually all of my undergraduates, I mean, my very first undergraduate, well, I've only got one undergraduate. That one was in sociology and politics of contemporary culture. So actually it felt more like a cultural studies degree than a sociology one. And then my master's was in media and cultural politics. So then I stepped even further away from sociology. But when I came back to writing my PhD, you know, Bourdieu was there, you know, right in the centre. And I kind of really had to deal with a lot of his, you know, his blind spots around gender, trying to figure out exactly how I could deploy Bourdieu within this kind of contemporary cultural studies moment, particularly with youth cultures, which have often been theorised as being much more exciting or deviant, you know, a lot more kind of exotic perhaps than sort of more adult cultures. And so I wanted to apply this kind of really mundane thing to everyday lives of young people. And actually I spent about 3 years really trying to get to grips with the sociological theory, which really isn't my language either as an academic or really as a human being. So I was trying to get my head around that. And it turned out that really, I mean, hopefully there'll be some other PhD students listening to this. It was something that I really wasn't sure if it was going to fit until right at the very last moment, where in my last year, I thought, you know what, Bourdieu can't speak to gender in this post-structural moment in the way that I need him to. So let's see if we can, you know, let Bourdieu open up this conversation about taste and then let Foucault take it from there. Really, that's kind of what I thought. I still don't know. I know that there's been a lot of, you know, a lot of work around gender and taste and Bourdieu and the idea of classification, but it's certainly not something that I've been able to solve. And there's certainly conversation around Bourdieu and gender and capital that I really hope other academics can have.
And the book, you know, this is why I was kind of gesturing towards it, makes this important theoretical contribution as well as having all of this kind of really rich and interesting detail. And that rich and interesting detail, I guess, is a product of your methodological kind of commitments. And, you know, you've mentioned engagements with feminism as well. So we probably need to know a bit, I guess, about not so much who the young people are, but what the context for the research was. Because quite early on in the book, you know, the sort of usual engagements that researchers have about their subjectivity and their position is bolstered by this sense of Norfolk is really important to this book. You know, the kind of the context in which you're doing the research really, really matters.
Yeah. Norfolk is a really interesting, I think, site of study because it's one that's completely overlooked within the academic field. And it's also one that I think is interesting as well, because, you know, it's rural and it's also not rural, and there are coastal towns. There's a lot of deprivation in Norfolk, and it's just a largely overlooked field. But one of the things that I really liked was the interactions that students, the young people who'd grown up outside of Norfolk, had with the kids that had grown up in Norfolk. There was one moment that I really liked where I think we're at Outskirts High, which is a mixed gender, pretty working class school. And two of the students said in the focus group, said to the class as a whole, like, I think if we were in London, our experiences would be really different. They had this sense that, like, there was this other place where they could be freer and they could be more open. But they felt that Norfolk was a little bit of a backwater, which as having grown up in Norfolk, is definitely my experience as well. There's this sense that, like, oh, well, we're not as progressive as we could be. A sense that it, maybe things will be better out there. And that's certainly something actually that they spoke about in terms of the regulatory role of taste as well. It wasn't just the sort of geographical location that they felt limited them, but also their age as well. They felt like once they got out of the high school, it would become different. And obviously, I think I gestured to that in the book. Like, I don't think I didn't have the heart to tell them that, like, it doesn't really get better, it just gets different. But yeah, that was one. Yeah, the space and the age of the young people was really important to the findings that I had. But I also think, you know, they are indicative of much wider trends of the way that taste regulates, if you say what I mean.
Yeah, I mean, that was going to be the kind of key question, I guess, to unpack the book is, like, well, how does taste regulate then? And I mean, that kind of prompts, you know, probably a massive long sort of answer. And I guess maybe to make it digestible for you, like, you know, to make it a fair question, maybe we could sort of kick off with a sense of, like, what did they think about gender? Like, what were kind of young people's conceptualizations of gender that you found?
Yeah, this was a chapter that I really enjoyed writing, because I think so many people, when they do gender research, they forget to ask the people that they're researching what they think about gender. And so as part of the research process, I talked through conceptions of gender with the focus groups in particular. And it seemed that, you know, young people really were open to these wider, conceptions of gender beyond the binary, cis and trans experiences of gender. But ultimately, when it came down to it, there was this kind of discoverability or knowability of gender that was underneath it all. So even if someone was presenting perhaps as non-binary or as gender fluid, they felt like there must be a way of knowing. There must be a way of ultimately, beneath everything else, maybe it's, you know, what genitalia they have or their chromosomes, but there is a discoverability of gender. And that's one of the things that really came through. So it was like they could imagine it and they could be progressive and think about gender beyond the binary. But ultimately, they needed it to be fixed for their own understandings as well.
And this, I mean, you know, this is where kind of taste comes in. And it's funny in a way, because when we start from that point of view, it makes it really obvious that taste would regulate both, you know, kind of presentations and experiences of gender. Mm. Because there are particular consequences, as you say, for kind of not fitting in with the right kinds of taste.
Yeah, absolutely. There really are consequences. And I think, I guess this is what I was, you know, sort of getting at a minute ago when they were sort of imagining that there were other geographical spaces or other time spaces where, you know, things would be better. And I think what they imagined would be better is that they wouldn't be as judged for being who they really wanted to be. I think they felt that in high school, and I refer to it as the hyper-regulatory space of high school, because of the way that these young people are kind of put into groups and often asked to spend entire days or weeks with the same cohort. You know, this sense of making, I think I refer to Irving Goffman actually, where it's like one off note can disrupt the entire performance, thinking about it like in terms of a piano. And I think that that's one of those things that the young people were really wary of. You know, they wanted to be able to present a coherent and a recognisably sort of appropriate, and not just gender identity, but actually all of the different facets of their identity, but gender was the one that I was focusing on. And what they really wanted to do was to not find themselves in a position where someone was either questioning their authenticity or making assumptions or attributing them to subjectivities with which they didn't identify.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
The sort of almost like obvious, almost kind of like bland, standard kind of understanding of this comes through masculinity and the boys. And, you know, I mean, both in terms of sort of academic research, but also in terms of maybe media discussions and possibly everyday life, we have a sense of, you draw on the language of the idea of a hegemonic form of masculinity as a kind of key idea. And yeah, it'd be good to know sort of what are the boys like, because that seems a really kind of straightforward example of that sense of kind of regulation and almost, I guess, the kind of fear of being misread.
Yeah, I think hegemonic masculinity is a really important concept in the book, and one that I think I demonstrate its perseverance, I guess, within in academic theory, because it was very much the sense that there were clear ideas as to what were appropriate masculine taste articulations, so things that it were appropriate for a boy to say that they liked. And it was regulated not just by boys but also by girls as well. You know, they all had a sense of what it is that boys should like, and it was just really, you know, it wasn't especially surprising. None of it was surprising. So things that demonstrated physical prowess or physicality, so that might be sport, which is within the literature really tied to hegemonic masculinity, but also other ways. So obviously not all boys like sport related things. I think most boys in academia came from backgrounds where they didn't like sport actually, but they preferred music. But ways in which, so the young people would find ways of reading kind of appropriately masculine reasons for liking something. So if boys didn't like football, they needed to kind of recuperate that through other taste articulations. So they would talk about music that they liked, but it would have to be some form of music that really demonstrated a particularly sort of active and physical mode of communicating that media through that medium. So it might be guitar playing. That's one of the things that I talk about. But also rap as well, like a kind of real verbal control. Whereas, you know, when girls were talking about the music they liked, you know, it was expected that girls would like something that, you know, was much more passive and fit the kind of the norms of sort of, you know, fangirl, not even necessarily fangirls, but girls like pop music. They like boys that they can look at, attractive people. So even if girls liked guitar music, it would be read differently. So it would be like, girls like this guitar music because they fancy the singer, rather than girls like this guitar music because they like the, you know, the technical ability of being able to play the guitar, which is something that boys were supposed to like. And boys really demonstrated a lot of mastery and over, you know, this kind of demonstrating knowledge over these particular taste cultures. So like an example of that would be something like Chuck Norris they talked about. And so the methods behind the book were I did a series of identity pages. And in these identity pages, young people would go online and they would write, they'd kind of use a framework similar to a Facebook page or a MySpace page or a Bebo page, as it was. Like I say, it took a really long time to write this book. And they would write down the things that they liked and disliked. And then what I did was I took a sample of those and I removed the gender icon from the middle, and then just asked people to guess what gender they thought someone was based on the tastes that they'd included. So one of the people that came up was Chuck Norris. And Chuck Norris, I wonder if maybe his moment has kind of passed within the popular moment. But, you know, back in the day, well, I say back in the day, about 5 or 6 so years ago, you know, he was really someone that you would Google, you know, can Chuck Norris do this? Chuck Norris can do that, whatever. And they really identified this kind of super hegemonic, you know, prototypical masculinity in him. And they would say, this is something that boys like. And then what they would do was, they would then demonstrate knowledge over Chuck Norris and pretty much just mansplain in the group. So you'd find that there would be some girls in the moment who would be like, oh yeah, doesn't Chuck Norris do this and doesn't Chuck Norris do that? And then the boys would say pretty much exactly the same thing that she'd said, but said it with more authority and conviction. So in those kind of ways, they would take ownership over particular masculine subjectivities. Other things that boys said that they liked would also, I think I've got a heading in one of the sections, so like boys like sexy girls. And there was one thing in it where like they would display this heterosexual masculinity as well. So they would talk about celebrities like Megan Fox was the one that kept coming up because she was mentioned on one of the identity pages. And through that, they could really objectify these women, and they could really perform this heterosexual longing for these particular celebrities. Whereas with femininity, there wasn't quite so much of a clear sense of what was feminine. It was kind of everything other that wasn't masculinity, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, it'd be good to know what the girls liked. You know, the sort of straightforward, obvious kind of next question about how was it different? How, you know, to an extent were... You talk later in the book, actually, how were the values of girls' tastes and, you know, taste commitments assigned lower values, you know, and you know, this telling us something about the lower value given to femininity and girls more generally.
Yeah, I think it's funny that at this particular moment in time that I should be talking about this, because I'm trying to write a paper at the moment about the value of femininity and how it works with gendered bodies. Because it's really complicated. And it's really complicated because it doesn't have that automatically hegemonic sort of structure underneath patriarchy as masculinity does. You know, it's really difficult for femininity, I think, to hold value under patriarchy. But of course, there are more idealized forms of femininity that are enjoyed by middle-class white able-bodied girls, perhaps, than girls who don't fit those kind of norms. And the girls seem to acknowledge that. They had a sense of there being a femininity that was idealized, and that was one where girls would, they would like things like, they would say that they liked things like romance texts and things like that. So chick flicks, all of those things that are kind of really derided within popular culture anyway, are the sort of things that girls would say, and boys would say, this is what we expect girls to like. Now, I think what's interesting is that the girls themselves said that they didn't find it especially, you know, this to be a subject position that they really wanted to take up. And in part of the book, what I actually talk about is how young girls distance themselves from feminine subjectivities because they really offer dissatisfying possibilities. And that's, I think, that's one of the things that I found trickiest to write about and to try and figure out, because there isn't really, there isn't the depth, I think, of understanding of how femininity works under patriarchy as there is of how masculinity works under patriarchy. And I think it's because it's complicated, because hegemony doesn't work the same way in feminine gender cultures as it does in masculine ones. So when they were thinking more about girls' tastes, I think what they were looking at was less the sort of texts that girls would be expected to like, actually, and more about the sort of ways of articulating tastes that were appropriate for girls. So it might be that girls, there weren't any particular celebrities that it was that girls would be expected to like, although, of course, they would be expected to like that. They wouldn't be expected to like particularly sort of masculine, hetero, you know, celebrities like Megan Fox, because it would be expected that they would actually, rather than sort of align themselves as, you know, fancying them in some kind of sexualized form, actually they would want to critique them. And so, yeah, one of the things that I found in the book was it was like, just having an opinion on celebrities was something that they expected girls to do. And that kind of comes into the, I talk about the sort of the feminine value of bitching, and how actually sort of bitching and slagging off particular female celebrities is a way of doing femininity. So it's less about the text itself and more about the means of communicating or articulating that taste.
What about regulation then? Because if we've got these two, say, different patterns of taste and different, you know, modes of expressions and relationships to, as you say, to texts, whether it's, you know, dominance and mastery of, I don't know, a guitar player's back catalogue versus, you know, having opinions on celebrities or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
What are the penalties for not doing that in the appropriate kind of gendered form? And how did people, I suppose, like, because towards the back end of the book, you engage much more directly with individual stories. So Joe and Tom, Anna and Naomi, who on the one hand, you know, are kind of like, quite powerfully, I think, challenging these norms, challenging the kind of regulatory role of these taste patterns, but also at the same time, never quite escape them either.
No, and this is where for a while I thought that I had a series of data that was about, you know, the queering and the troubling and, you know, the pushing back against these hegemonic taste cultures. But actually what I realised, the more I looked at it and the more that I worked through the different ways in which these young people were pushing back or problematising or not quite being 100% in sort of the ideal, appropriate articulator of taste, I guess, was actually so many of their tastes by the wider group were then recuperated, you know, under the heterosexual matrix into a way that actually didn't really trouble too much in the end at all. So I talk a little bit about for masculine subjectivities and inappropriate tastes done by those that presented as boys. Yeah, I drew on Joe and Tom, and they were both quite different actually in terms of the way that they did it. So Tom, you know, inhabits a non-white, non-Norfolk body. Joe is very much Norfolk. He's very white as well. But they secured their masculinity in different ways. So the thing that the boys are scared of mostly is being called gay. And I was really surprised in the wake of, you know, a lot of the inclusive masculinity theory that actually this was going to, you know, this perseveres as a problem within boys' lives. But they really didn't want to be called gay unless they were, unless they actually identified as gay. Whereas with the girls, the thing that I kind of found, so I talked about Anna and Naomi, who align much more heavily with masculine taste cultures. So both Anna and Naomi really like football. That was one of the things that came out of it. And it seemed to me that girls had this kind of, they were under this almost like a double-edged sword, really, because they could do what they wanted, which is really freeing, but actually the only reason they could do what they wanted is because there was very little consequence to deviating, because they had less to lose. So it was fear of homosexualization was what regulated the boys, I think, quite a lot. Whereas with the girls, so in some instances, the girls would be teased, but not in the same way that the boys would be teased if they aligned themselves a lot with masculine subjectivities. So girls would probably be teased because they were expected that they were trying to get on a level with boys. I think that's one of the things that one of the respondents said. Or being a bit try hard, whereas the boys didn't necessarily, they didn't have that. They just had the fear of homosexualization. Now, one thing that I really liked or enjoyed writing about in that chapter on transgressions is the example of one of the Identity Page prompt writers who described himself as a manly male. And he's the one I was talking about earlier who mentioned Chuck Norris. He said he didn't like Hello Kitty. Like all of the things that were kind of atypical, were completely what you'd expect of a sort of a standard normative gender subjectivity. So all the things that were feminine, he rejected. All of the things that were masculine, like super masculine, hyper masculine, he embraced. And actually, that's one of the things that all of the focus group participants really latched onto. And they were, you know, they thought maybe he was trying just a little bit too hard. So in that sense, I think it problematized the certainty of the hegemonic system. You know, it wasn't just that display the most and you'll have the most power. You know, it had to be done in an authentic way. So because actually demonstrating too much of that, being too try hard, they thought then perhaps he had something to hide. And then in that moment, it was about, maybe he's gay, but he's pretending he's not gay by liking all of these things, by being overly performatively masculine, if that makes sense.
That sort of gestures towards how much of a massive downer it is being in high school. As you say, you know, it's kind of everything is hyper because you're in this, you know, enclosed space with all these different rules and stuff like that. And I suppose this is it's both an antidote to a lot of discussions I guess the kind of optimism of things get better, or you know, things might be changing, but also it helps us to explain why we see, you know, discussions of young people as being under particular kinds of pressure, and you know, entirely justifiably kind of reacting badly to that. But I guess that the kind of the end of the book is about not ambivalence, but you know, a kind of a sense of the young people understanding this in a way. And I was really struck, you know, I picked out this comment that you'd highlighted by Naomi about, you know, things are really hard to change, actually. You know, it takes a lot of work, and that kind of sense of ambivalence captured, I think, a lot of how complicity isn't the right word, is it? But you know, the young people are invested in this system as much as it limits them and, you know, shapes and regulates them.
Yeah, and Naomi, actually, I really enjoyed having Naomi in the group because I felt like Naomi was the most exasperated out of all of them. She just seemed perpetually tired in a way that she was just tired of the need to kind of be performative all the time. You know, this need to perform in high school in order to fit in. And yeah, at the end, it was actually at the end of one of the sessions, you know, as people were starting to file out of the group, out of the room, she said to me, she said, what do you want to do with this? You know, which is a question that I thought I'd answered in the consent forms, but clearly I hadn't. And I said to her, I was like, well, I just want to figure out what's going on with young people, try and figure out, you know, I can't remember exactly what I said, something along the lines of, I just want to try and figure out what's stopping you being able to be who you really want to be. And she said, yeah, that's that's impossible. Like, it's like, you can't do that. Like, she was just exasperated. She, I think she was just a really representative of the work and the labor that goes into performing appropriately at high school. And so I did really want to respond to that in the publication that I wanted to come out of my PhD. So I talked about it in my PhD thesis, but I wanted to be able to say, you know what, if you're going to pick up this book and you're going to read all this stuff, actually, what can we do about it? And yeah, it's going to take a long time. I think we have, as adults, we always put a lot of hope into young people, but we forget that young people are also as tired as we are a lot of the time. So I think we owe it to young people to be actively trying to do things to better their lives and to contribute to culture shifts. So one of the things that I do in my spare time is I run a girl empowerment community group. And, you know, and that's one of the ways that I think, you know, getting out into the community, we can actually start to do some things that challenge gender norms, patriarchy, all of those sorts of things. But I think it's particularly important in Norfolk, where a lot of parents, you know, haven't enjoyed university education, where they are living in poverty, where actually just having a moment just to think about the consequences of some of the ways that we talk about things, you know, those consequences on young people's lives. You know, that's one kind of thing that we can do. I also think we can really lobby for teachers. I think one of the things that I really noticed in this is that, you know, teachers are tired. It was hard to get access to young people, you know, to do the research. And teachers are increasingly being asked to do more and more. And they're also being driven to contribute to league tables in much the same way that higher education is as well. So, you know, if we can make it easier for them to be able to talk about gender within the school, that would be, I think, one such way that we could contribute to a culture shift and hopefully, you know, change it a little bit so that people like Naomi don't feel exasperated and tired all the time.
You'd mentioned doing projects beyond the university. Is that where you're kind of looking in terms of future academic work, or are you going to do, you know, another book around these themes? I mean, it's probably, you know, a sort of trite comment, but it'd be interesting to see what happens to these young people, you know, the extent to which not only the regulatory space of the school, but, you know, Norfolk as well, like, you know, are the likes of Naomi thinking in terms of, I have to go to London, you know, which is quite a common sort of trope around the way that Britain is organised in terms of the kind of spatial geography of affordances for expressions of identity. Or is it time to like dump all this stuff and do something else entirely?
I would like to return to this at some point. But yeah, I'm at that point now where, you know, I feel like I've exhausted it. I do want to think about, you know, conceptualizations of femininity and think about how femininity works within young people's lives. And also to try and think about that theoretically as well, and to think about femininity underneath patriarchy. In terms of the community work that I do, I will always keep doing that. I think working in the community is one of the ways that really, I think, sustains me as an academic, because it, you know, it gets me out into the world and, you know, having conversations, which I really enjoy having. Not all of them are easy, but they are ones that I do, you know, yeah, I do enjoy talking to young people and older people about, you know, issues tied around feminism. I think where I go next, though, I think I need to take a little bit of a break with hands-on stuff, you know, talking to young people. And actually, I think what I'm really keen to do is to think about ways in which we can encourage resistances and how they can be played out. So I've been a long-term lover of zines. I don't know if you're familiar with zines, but yeah. I just absolutely love zines. And so I really love the way that zines can get us to take a little bit of time to think about the changes that we want to see and to work collaboratively to get them. So I think my next project is probably going to go down that sort of path, because, you know, the more time I spend in academia, the more time I spend thinking about patriarchy and the impact that that has on everybody's lives, you know, okay, well, what can we do? And what can we do in a way that isn't just me writing a journal article, you know, like that, those aren't largely read. What I want to do is to do something that speaks to people from a range of different backgrounds. And I think zines do that really nicely. And so I think, all going well, I think the direction that I'm going in now is probably zine culture and finding ways to encourage resistances within communities.